committee will come to order. This morning we are continuing hearing and possible work session on House Bill 5053, the Oregon Department of Transportation. Ms. Jordan, apparently you want to make some comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing I wanted to point out is that I also handed out for the members the OFO recommendation for the work session tomorrow on the Marine Board for you to take a look at in advance.
Okay.
Other than that, we're ready to go on with that.
Okay. Central Services Division, Mike Marsh, Linda Gilbert. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. I think we'll do Linda first. She may have to split between committees this morning.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Member of the committee, Linda Gilbert. Department of Administrative Services.
How about this?
The overview for Central Services begins with a governor's revised budget of $127.7 million. It is 16.8% over the 97-99 legislatively approved budget. This is mostly due to year 2000 mitigation strategy, information systems inflation, technical staffing realignment. It continues all the functions of Central Services, and it transfers information technology functions from other divisions to Central Services. It includes seven policy option packages that implement Y2K remediation strategies, cover extraordinary inflation, bring the contractor to state staff ratio closer to 50-50, and provide additional support for traffic management and operations. There's a package to strengthen audit and tax collection functions, one to identify and reduce limitations for less essential activities. And there are also some position shifts between non-limited and central services according to the demand-driven nature of their work. The legislatively adopted budget in 97-99 was $107.4 million. Emergency board actions through April included employee compensation cost increase of $1.9 million, other funds, and a small final contract payment for an educational video.
On that emergency board action, the employee compensation cost increase, $1.9 million other funds, was that absorbed out of existing positions either by not filling their retirements or whatever?
Sure, I believe it, yeah, came out of ending balance, covered by ending balance.
So this bill has what to recreate those positions, anything? In other words, say you attributed 60 positions last, this current buy-in to absorb the pay increase. Then how many of those 60 are potentially back on the line for adding back to this budget?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that's the way it was done.
Sure, Mr. Chair. The situation was that we had a significant amount that was not covered in the salary adjustment funds, and so we, through additional efficiencies in the current biennium, identified ways to cover those costs. Those costs then are brought in into the base budget for 99-01, and some of those costs also come out in terms of our options for change, which are our reduction options, which we're implementing. So the fact of the matter is that we have continuing efficiencies next biennium. Those positions, though, are covered in the base budget of the agency. Does that answer your question?
But they're not part of a roll-up cost?
Mr. Chair, they are part of a roll-up cost. And because of the salary increases this last biennium, there is a more significant personal services roll-up cost in all agencies than there have been the last 10 years or so.
Okay. Now, when you have a projected roll-up cost, is that part of the 16% increase that you're talking about here? Or would the 16% increase be lower if it actually didn't have these additional roll-up costs?
Mm-hmm. Or if it did not have the roll-up cost.
Okay. Can you indicate the amount of FTE that's involved?
Mr. Chair, if all the FTE, we can indicate the amount of money that's involved in terms
that's
of how much.
$1.9
million. The roll-up amount would be more than that, looking at the whole biennium, but we can track that down.
Okay. Because I think it'd be helpful to give us an example where we underfund something and then what the net cost is in the next biennium. You think you're saving something up front, but it's costing you more in the subsequent biennium. And I think it'd be helpful for the committee members to see the relationship between the two. Thank you.
Significant current service level budget adjustments include a phase out of three 9799 packages for network stabilization, phase out of year 2000 mitigation package and telephone system upgrade, and that was a total of $18.6 million. And also at the end of the current service level section, there were 39 positions transferred and $17.6 million to Central Services from Information Systems Departments in Highway Motor Carrier in DMV in order to centralize the information systems function. There are seven policy packages. The first deals with Y2K and 16 limited duration positions to assist with the completion and post-implementation work on the agency's data systems. This is $9.1 million other fund. Second package is information technology services inflation. Y2K work, for instance, is estimated to have as much as 40% inflation. This package requests $3.6 million additional limitation to cover inflation. The third package, 107, is information system efficiency. This reduces reliance on contractors by replacing maintenance contractors in selected areas with 27 staff positions, and it adds 5 positions in critical service areas. The object is to get the ratio of contract staff to state staff to 50-50, and that is to improve stability by reducing turnover. The package is funded by a reduction in professional services plus $1.1 million assessed to the other programs in ODOT, so it's a total of $1.15 million, 32 positions. In options for change, as in other areas within the agency, this package reduces less essential costs in order to meet more critical needs in other areas. In this case, the reduction is $1.9 million in other funds in professional services for non-Y2K activity. Package 131 on page 3 of the handout, audit and fuel tax collection, strengthens the agency's ability to collect delinquent taxes. The package is contingent on the passage of House Bill 2189 and House Bill 2190. Package 139 is budget realignment. This moves the reprographics unit from Central Services into non-limited. The unit operates like other non-limited programs with costs and revenues driven by demand from its customers. This package also moves 2 positions from non-limited to purchasing in Central Services because their work has changed to supplying the entire department with their services. This is a minus $1.3 million other funds and a reduction of 9 positions to Central Services. Finally, Package 150, Traffic Management and Operation, provides information system staff support for additional automated roadside information. This is offset by Package 105 in Highway, and it's $200,000 in 2 positions. Revisions to the Governor's recommended budget included...
Excuse me, Linda. Yes.
This item for GF, on Package 107, I assume the agency will elaborate on the 50-50 ratio and the goal and all that.
Same question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. With regard to 107, 116, the reduction in professional services, we'll find out which professional services are being reduced there.
Into the governor's recommended budget includes reversing a $48,000 item that had been transferred from DMV for state telephone lines. These are actually voice telephone lines. You should stay with DMV. And we transfer three positions from support services branch within non-limited to the central services division to correctly align with the actual duties. The total revisions are $353,000. Other funds in the governor's revised budget total to $127.7 million.
Okay, thank you, Linda. Are there any questions by committee members? Representative Patrick.
I just got a question on 107 while we're there in terms of that review. You're going to, would this like a, an additional 27 positions? Is it a shift or is it an additional 27 positions that you didn't have before? That ODOT didn't have before?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patridge, it is not a shift, it's a replacement of contract workers.
Right.
With state staff.
I guess everything that I've seen on information systems and where the state's at or where government's at or generally is that everyone's falling off and going to the private sector and not staying with the government. So I'm wondering why we're switching away from contracted services to in-house staff when we can't compete with the private sector in terms of staying up to speed with information systems. And sure. Programs are these real highly specialized.
I'd be happy to cover that now, or we can cover it in the regular.
We'll do it in our regular presentation, Mike. We'll just highlight the question now, and then when you get to that session, we can identify it.
I'd like DAF to win, because I'm wondering what kind of, I mean, on a statewide basis, what DAF is trying to do with this question.
Chair Representative Patrick, by including it in the governor's recommended budget, we do support it, and we have a similar package in another agency that I'm aware of on the grounds of reducing turnover and the costs associated with turnover.
Let me ask a question and see somewhat like the representative. If we're going to rely more specifically on contracted help and hire in-service people, is there a wage decrease if they go from contracting to a state employee position? In other words, if I'm a contractor working for ODOT to make it Y2K compliant and I'm getting X amount of dollars, then you roll me into the state government and pay me, do I get the same, more, or less?
Mr. Chair, I believe you get less.
Ms. Jordan.
In the last biennium, the Department of Administrative Services did do a review of the market for information systems positions and has implemented an increase in salaries for all of those positions across the agencies in an attempt to mitigate that loss that we were experiencing of our IS people to the private sector. So the gap has been lessened, but we do still pay less than the private sector.
Let me ask you this one. What is to lead us to believe most companies, organizations are Y2K compliant by now that's going to be meeting the conditions on January 1st. We're hiring these additional staff positions. What leads us to believe that we need them after the Y2K compliance? Because that's what you really talk about here is the year 2000 compliance. And then you add all these different positions for 16 for limited durations in 101, 27 positions in 107. There should be a lot of computer people.
Mr. Chair, package 101 is the Y2K package, and that continues limited duration positions. So it wouldn't.
For how long?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure until it's done, but probably.
But limited duration could be in the biennium.
Mr. Chair, some of those positions will be phased out in 6 months, some will be phased out 18 months, and some will stay for the entire 24 months and be phased out at the end of the biennium. They're there for some very specific tasks related to Y2K. And that's why they're designated as limited duration.
But package 107 is not a year 2000 package. It's an ongoing operations package.
And, Mr. Chair, just to make sure we're clear, that obviously the January 1st, 2000 is the biggest date, but there are also several other dates the members have probably heard about. September 9th, 1999 is one issue because of the 9999. The first quarter in the year 2000 is another concern. Also, the fact that it's a leap year. There are several different programming concerns beyond just January 1st. That's what they'll be working towards. Plus, we are focusing on the critical systems first to make sure those are done by September. The other ones that are less critical are ones we have less potential risk on, but want to make sure those are completed also and deal with all those different dates.
Okay. Representative Schrader.
In your course, your presentation, Mike, I'd like you to address the overall info systems, because, I mean, it's a $72 million budget alone. I mean, that's pretty huge, and I guess I would wonder why some of these positions that have been referenced here maybe couldn't be taken out of the existing information systems personnel that you have.
And there's something else I'd like to cover. When we asked you to absorb this biennium salary increases for your employees, and you absorb those by attrition, retirement, not filling positions, a combination of things, if we were to give you a salary package for the next biennium, it would cause you to blow that. Where would those positions come from?
Mr. Chair, when we are underfunded on salary adjustments, there are several ways those are absorbed. Obviously, each agency tries to find efficiencies in terms of their services and supplies in other areas. If that's not enough to make up for the difference, and the positions are held vacant when a vacancy does occur and there's a movement of an incumbent out of a position, we hold those positions vacant until we're sure we have enough money to fund the salary increases that are mandated by the collective bargaining agreement.
Okay. Because I'll be real candid with you, Mike. My problem is the reductions are always made at the bottom in most cases that I've ever dealt with state agencies. The reduction is typically made at the bottom. It's not made at the top and the administrative level, the assistant administrative level, it's just right at the middle level of management. It's always somehow, well, we won't fill a snowplow position in Ashland, Oregon, and we'll count that towards our net savings. And meantime, some of the middle management positions continue to flourish. And when you talk about a 50-50 match here on your computer, that's a pretty substantial ratio for one person for one supervisor. Is that what you're saying with that?
Mr. Chair, what we're getting at with the 50-50 is that it's a balance of contractors compared to employees in the information systems area. So 50% contractors, 50% employees. And we'll talk about it later, but that's the industry standard, and we're below that standard right now. We're more towards the two-thirds, one-third. With the two-thirds being the contractors, and we're trying to move it back towards a balance between the two, which is what industry suggests in order to have enough experience and to have the continuity of the work that's done after they're completed.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, if there are any other questions of the Department of Administrative Services, I'll turn to our overview and field any questions at any time. And I know Representative Patrick will keep me honest on getting back to his questions. I want to indicate first that the Central Services Division and the Central Services function exist because there are functions that are best provided centrally. We don't try to weight down the Central Services area, the area where we feel like bringing the information and functions in results in a more efficient way to produce program and support the overall agency. So it's more efficient and effective that way. The programs that are involved are consist of the people who work hard to ensure that we're doing the customer service for the agency. The overall areas are on page one of the handout that shows Central Services Division. And I'll start through that. The director's office, the director of immediate support staff, means the director and three physicians that support her, as well as the chief engineer. Also, the transportation commission receives support from those individuals. The communications division consists of two elements, government relations, which relates to coordinating legislative issues, requests for information, federal programs, which are very complicated to explain. A lot of questions come in from the citizenry. In addition, they do analysis of the federal information that's coming down and congressional action and provide information back to the Congress about needs within Oregon. Also, they work significantly with local government partners and resolve issues in terms of communication and getting information to our local government partners. The other side of that communications program is the public affairs and employee communications area, where we work with all divisions. Each one of those divisions has a contact person in terms of the communications issues. In a large decentralized organization like ODOT, we need to make sure that we're getting the information out, communicating well with the public, but also our employees, and making sure they're understanding the direction of the organization, making sure we're getting the questions answered, and also getting information out to the public. We have a very active and involved public at ODOT, which I think that the members know. There's a lot of information about the seasonal issues, whether it's studded tires or a closure of a road because of snow conditions or whatever it might be, to make sure that information is getting out. The other central services areas are the ones that one would think of in terms of financial services. That means accounting, audits, and fuel tax collection, cost accounting, which we'll talk about more significantly later, and I'm sure Representative Butler will target that one. We've got a lot of concern about economic forecasting, making sure we have a good forecast on the revenues received, as well as making sure that overall, within the area of finance, that we have quality and reliable information to work with. Second area, human resources. In that area, we've returned to what I would call core competencies. Some of the members may recall we'd expanded a little bit into areas that may have been outside of the area of what you think of core human resource functions, and we've tightened that up to be recruitment, classification, labor relations, and safety. The area of training, we still have a training function, but it's been significantly reduced from where it was before. Information systems is, as mentioned earlier, a critical area which involves supporting all ODOT business areas. The applications, especially in the systems that are most complex, DMV, motor carrier, financial services, highway, maintenance and engineering are primary areas. And then support services is the central services component, at least of support services, relates to purchasing and contract management and business services functions. We'll talk more about those later in the discussion. Mr. Chair, the main emphasis is that we are here to focus on customers, which are the operating divisions. We respond to ODOT customers as well as external customers, and our goal is to work cooperatively with those customers to competitively deliver services. Determining that competition level is one of the reasons for our true product cost or cost accounting system, to make sure that we have the information to determine how are we doing compared to other potential service providers. And we're doing so in a way that ensures that there's accountability and information that flows to our operating divisions, as well as making sure our processes are as efficient and as effective as they can be. Briefly, on the second page, Mr. Chair, is the organization chart for the agency. We've got, again, several functions there. The communications area, where we have a request for more information, not less. It's, in essence, one person deep in each region and division to make sure we have coverage to get communication out to each area. Financial services, that financial services function, as I mentioned earlier, involves several different components. Just taking a minute to talk about the subcategories: accounting operations, the budget, the data and systems administration, financial analysis, audits and review, which means our internal audit function. We're required by the federal government to have a significant internal audit function, which helps us to determine that our functions are being clear and on track, as well as allows for an opportunity for employees who have concerns to let our internal audit function know about those concerns, and we can have internal audits to ensure that we're meeting the requirements of the federal government, as well as making sure our funds are flowing appropriately. Human resources area, as I mentioned earlier, we've narrowed that down so that there's not as much in the training side. We've significantly reduced that side of the program and have what I would call a core training program. Employee relations is another component, and then recruitment and classification, as the members are aware. And DAS mentioned earlier, we have significant challenges in hiring engineers into state government because the pay levels, the session in 1997 did increase the pay level for engineers, which is increasing our ability to compete. It's still a challenging time. The same thing is true for information systems professionals. And in the area of safety, we'll talk more about that under the performance measures category, but we do have a significant safety issue, both in terms of employees working on the roadway, as well as the other functions of carrying and dealing with a lot of physical movement in the work that we do. And Mr. Chair, the bottom line in all those are we're trying to work with our operating elements to make sure that we have good stewardship of public funds and stewardship of our information technology resources. Next page, just some of the issues, Mr. Chair, that involve the central services area. I mentioned explaining T21 implementation to customers. It is a busy, complex area, both in dealing with our local government partners, as well as the legislature, as well as the citizenry, on communicating what is and is not in terms of earmarked projects, in terms of what's happening with T21, where there is flexibility, where there's not. On year 2000 compliance, it's not just an information systems problem, but also relates to many areas of non-information systems work. We are working through that now, and all of ODOT's major systems have been analyzed and are ready for meeting the year 2000 standards. In terms of completion, we have two-thirds that are certified, over 90% have completed conversion, and all sectors of ODOT have completed at least 75% of the testing and certification work. We're not one of the agencies targeted as being red or of significant concern by the DAS review. In terms of other issues there, cost accounting and allocation.
Excuse me, Mike. Thank you very much.
So you're 75% compliant at this point in time? Is that what you said?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schrader, I said that 75% of the testing and certification work has been done. On the ones where we're done, it's 100%. There's nothing that we have completed that has an ongoing problem. And we can talk in more detail about that if the members have it. If we'd like to get into it, I have a chart I can hand out that gets more into it. Other issues, the work of the cost accounting and allocation I mentioned earlier, this is critical to the agency to ensure the accountability that I know the members want and that our department director wants to ensure for ODOT. I know there's been concern about this and apparently some discussion of this issue in past sessions. I can guarantee the members we will have a cost accounting system. There is a bill, Senate Bill 614, which would also require it. If the bill passes, there'll be a cost accounting system. If the bill doesn't pass, there'll be a cost accounting system. I just want to make sure the members understand that we are committed to ensuring that occurs. We, of course, will work with legislative guidance about cost accounting if the bill passes with different kinds of direction. But what we're trying to do is make sure that we meet your needs regardless of what happens with the legislation.
Mike, is there any difference between the cost accounting as being proposed in the legislation and your perception of what cost accounting is?
Mr. Chair, in terms of the legislation, I think the bill has gone through several iterations, and as the bill started, it was pretty general and caused no concern. As it's gotten more specific, I think it's still workable in terms of how we define cost accounting. Some of the amendments that have been discussed, though, would have caused some concern. I think we're really getting into a different element, some of which is covered by House Bill 2478, which talks about project reporting. And I don't want to bore the members with a detail of cost accounting, but what we're really trying to do with the cost accounting is determine what our cost per unit of service is. It does not exist to have a project reporting about how a project is doing at a particular point in time. We understand the concerns from the legislature about ensuring we communicate how projects are doing with that in a different way. If we try to put that into the cost accounting bill and change definitions, it can make the cost accounting more difficult and make it difficult for the audit function from Secretary of State to do the auditing. So we're trying to keep the needs clear and succinct and still make sure we're meeting them.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Mike, in the Transportation Committee, when we discussed the cost accounting bill, I suggested that the accounting system should be developed in consultation with Secretary of State's office, the Auditor's Division, and the Controller's office, because I think that if a system is developed with their agreement, the two officers' agreement, I think the two officers will be able to work with you a lot better. What is their comment? Because you said you will check with the other two officers.
Mr. Chair, if I did talk with both the State Controller's Division and the Secretary of State Audit's Division with John Latimer, he was fine with the legislation as proposed by the Senator. We'll make sure we work closely with them through the process. Even if the bill did not pass, we will do that, and I commit to that, but the wording is in the latest amendment in the bill, and we're okay with that.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I just want to make sure all the terms you use are in agreement with each other, because it seems to me they can define administrative costs one way, and you can define administrative costs another way, and this will affect what exactly goes into the program. So I'd like to have all the terms be defined in agreement with each other before the work goes on.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we are working closely together, and I think we have the same definitions. The area of concern is whether one would consider indirect to be overhead or not. And I think it can be considered that way. Some of our indirect functions in ODOT are pretty close to online functions as compared to some agencies. But we will work closely with them, and I think our definitions are going to be the same.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chair, thank you.
Okay.
Continuing on the issues area of worker safety, as I mentioned, we have significant concerns about safety. A few years ago, we were listed as one of the 30 dozen agencies by the Risk Management Division of Department of Administrative Services, indicating we had to do some work there and reduce our accident rates and safe claim rates. We've done so. We're not at that same level. As we get on into the performance measures and look at the detail, we'll show how we've done. I guess the bottom line there is that through employee concern and management work, we have been able to reduce the safe claim rate and reduce the concerns about safety with our employees so that they are in a more safe condition. Staff turnover has been mentioned before. We do have a significant movement as the baby boom approaches retirement. We're having a problem within our department, both for the engineers who are leaving as well as information systems professionals and others. We've moved from a 7% turnover rate in 1994 to an 11% turnover rate in 1998. So we're having to make sure we stay ahead of that and have a plan for growing our bench strength for our folks who are coming up to take those people's place. Customer service, as I mentioned, is an area of concern. We want to make sure that we are meeting the needs of the customers rather than having them perceive that we are the customer of Central Services. We know the customers in the operating division, so we're there to serve them and make sure we work cooperatively with them and understand their business. Under the needs area, we're supporting greater commitment to information systems. As I mentioned earlier, there's a significant need for information from the operating divisions. We want to make sure that we're meeting that need and doing so in a logical way within the entire agency. We're implementing increased project reporting requirements. We've heard and are listening to the concerns from members about project reporting and making sure information is getting to members about where projects are. So again, we're making sure that that information is put together in a logical fashion, and we'll plan on quarterly reports, regardless of what happens with House Bill 2478, make sure we're getting that information out so members know how projects are doing in their district, as well as the public in understanding how those projects are going. Also, reducing reliance on contracted IT services. We'll talk about that specifically in the decision package on this subject, but suffice to say that we've become too dependent on contractors and want to achieve that industry standard of the 50-50 comparison between contractors and employees. One of the reasons is that the contractor turnover rate of individual people who are working as contractors for us has been at a 40% turnover rate. Our own employees are high at a 12% rate, but significantly less, so we have more expertise that's retained, and we can stop that brain drain that's occurring. And as I say, ensuring the effective customer service, we're working on improving our work processes as well as our service delivery. Next page, Mr. Chair, is page 4, cost control, talking about outcomes. Just to summarize a few of these, We did work hard on efficiency savings in this interim between last session and this. We'll talk about some of those through the program option package on cost savings itself, but in several other areas, found areas to reduce, including the workers' comp claim costs, as well as merging our mail and coffee center with Department of Administrative Services, which the members may remember as a budget note from last session. We've worked with them, and as you can see, we've got cost avoidance savings as well as operating cost savings, which total $673,000. Performance measures and benchmarks, and Mr. Chair, we're trying to make sure that information is out internal to the organization for decision making. We feel that in the absence of information, one opinion is as good as the other. So we want to make sure we have good solid information for that decision making. Some of that is when we're comparing our own costs to contractors. Some of it's when we're making decisions about what the priority or risks are within decisions in the organization. Factors driving our costs and include the need for information, the fact that we've got one answer for the decision making and not resulting in going on the basis of hip pocket information. The results that we've been able to achieve key on several different kinds of performance measures, cost per unit, customer satisfaction through surveys of our customers, as well as surveys by our operating units like maintenance of citizens, reduced response time, employee communication surveys to see how the employees feel that we're doing. All these things are ones that we use for information to determine where we need to place our priorities. The first performance measure shown there is the state calculated premium, which has gone down in the period. Again, we've moved from being a main Department of Administrative Services for our safety concerns to receiving the DAS Risk Management Award for meeting our goals in 1998. Another performance measure showing there is the purchasing contracts processing time, which is talking about the time it takes us to process contracts and working with our supported customers. And through this period, even though we've been able to make a reduction in the process time, we've had about a 10% increase in the contracts coming through the process. We feel like that's improving in the efficiency there. DMV applications availability is talking about a major concern about customer service is if those DMV employees don't have access to the computer because it's down, like it was in prior biennia when it got up to a point of being ready only 85% of the time, so therefore down 15% of the time. That resulted in a lot of the increase in long lines. So the information systems group has worked hard to make sure that we're improving that. As you can see by the chart, in the last recent quarters, we have not gone down below 98%. 99% is our target. Recently, last quarter, it went down a bit, but we're back to a straight 99% and above the last several days, and I believe that that's on track. Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions about performance measures at this time, we'll move to the accomplishment area for 1997-99 on page 5.
Representative Butler?
One question, Mr. Chair, is the approximately 40% savings in the accident deductible fund calculated premium attainable during the 1999 year from $2.5 million down to $1.5 million. That's 40% savings.
Correct, Mr. Chair,
and Representative Butler. That's going to actually happen.
Mr. Chair, how that works with SAFE is that they calculate what the premium would be to share our history over the last several years to determine that if the amount of funds that are required need to be billed to us, they bill us. If they have overbilled us in the past and that's so that they don't need to bill us, then they will not bill us. And the situation right now is that they have overbilled us enough in the past that we are not going to need to make a payment because it has gone down so much. So right now, the payment is something that we will not have to actually spend because we have saved due to the actions.
So as opposed to a 40% savings, it's really a reduction as a result of overpayments in the past?
No, Mr. Chair, the payment situation, this is safe calculated. In other words, if we hadn't overpaid in the past, that aside, what would be our payment? And that even given that, it means that our experience has gone down. So this shows what we would have paid if there hadn't been overcharging in the past.
I see.
The situation with SAFE is an interesting one with the state, Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler. They have, due to their calculation process, it takes some time to get it through, and by the time they have gotten the final calculation, many times agencies have gone down. So right now, most agencies are paying very little, if any, if they have improved their workers' comp costs.
Okay, further questions? You want to go ahead and proceed, Mike.
Okay. Mr. Chair, on the accomplishments for 1997-99, I'll try to go through this expeditiously here. I think we're getting tight for time. Improved collections of delinquent tax accounts. We are increasing revenues from the motor carrier accounts by $7 million through improved collections and more intensive auditing efforts. We converted to the state financial management system. Senator Yee has been a close tracker of that system, and ODOT had not been part of that system until this biennium. We are now connected to FFMS at a summary level, and we'll be looking at connecting at a detail level in the future as we evaluate what's called the TEAMS, or Transportation Accounting Management System, as we evaluate how to make transitions from that and better deal with our accounting system as well as cost accounting. ODOT Efficiency Committee in this last interim, I think the members are aware, some of the members of the committee here were on that committee. It worked through with a lot of recommendations, and Central Services has a key part in implementing many of those and also in working with the committee during the last interim, as well as assuming it does continue on reviewing us and making sure we're implementing what was recommended on working with them in the future. On the Salmon Initiative training, our human resources area has trained staff to look at design, construction, and maintenance of culverts in a way that allows for fish passage, and those folks have done that that training. Information systems availability.
Yeah, Senator Duke.
Mike, is it possible to put a dollar figure with the Salmon Initiative training, what it costs you to train the people?
Mr. Chair and Senator Duke, I believe so. I'll get that and track it down.
Okay.
We'll do that. And I mentioned the rest of the items here, I think, Mr. Chair, already. The electronic funds transfer piece is the one I didn't, and this is where we work with our motor carriers to ensure the maximum amount of sending their funds in electronically. We have 50% that we've achieved to date. Hope to increase that for the future. It is a more efficient way for us to receive the funds and less labor-intensive. Representative Schrader mentioned earlier under in the overview about the information systems portion of the budget, that it is a big cost, and I want to just spend a minute on a couple points there. One is that the information system budget as a percentage of revenue is something that we're trying to track into from the standpoint of having national performance measures. And we've looked at the that variable and find that the national average for information systems budgets as a percent of revenue is 5.57%. They separate average from median. Median is 4.18%, and ODOT is 3.79%.
Also, my question too is, as you start to break these costs and overheads out and you try to show an accurate figure, the concept of cost accounting and what you're trying to do here still keeps raising itself in my mind. Over if it costs so much per mile to put down 6 inches of asphalt thick or 6 inches of concrete thick, how can you relate to the cost per mile in the urban center versus the cost per mile in a rural area? And say that we apply the same standard, but the cost doesn't translate out to the same cost per mile because you have geographic differences in the area that you serve. So how do you address that? I mean, it's nice to know it costs $50 a square foot or a square yard or whatever else to pay. But how do you translate that into a geographic area that's different and you have to fix fill before you can actually pave it?
Mr. Chair, good question. We have to make sure that the specificity of the information in cost accounting gives us enough detail that we can make a comparison between regions. For instance, we have five regions. One of the obvious categorizations that we'll work with is the difference between those five regions. So in terms of doing overlay work in Region 1 in working through downtown Portland, that's going to be one thing compared to working through something in Region 5 outside of Vail. So we would expect there would be significant differences. Some of those will be offsetting differences. It may be that contractors may be more expensive in one area, but issues of working around current traffic and congestion would balance the other way. So the overall cost may not end up being all that much different because there'll be an increased cost on one side and an increase on the other. But we need to have that information so we can make those comparisons.
Okay, and I think that leads to the other question. What we're going to be looking at is zero-based budgeting on the maintenance side, I think. Isn't that what we're...
Mr. Chair, we're planning a summary that relates to zero-based and the...
And my concern is, as you apply the cost-sharing standard to a zero-based budget, does that zero-based budget take into consideration the different geographic conditions? To do an overlay on one stretch of Highway 62 in Eastern Oregon, or coming over and doing a stretch on I-5, you can't necessarily relate the two, and you're breaking it down to that specific project and that alone, rather than lumping it all together in one lump sum and saying, this is how much we're going to spend for maintenance. Is that fair characterization of what you're trying to do?
Well, Mr. Chair, in the zero-based budget overview, we'll give the members probably on Wednesday. We do not have incorporated yet cost accounting because we don't have that information back yet. When we have the cost accounting system implemented, we could use information from it to talk about zero-based. The concern is that, as you say, if one goes into extreme detail in a zero-based system, you can determine what would be the cost of a 5% increment of maintenance work in Region 5 as compared to Region 1. It does get very labor-intensive, though, in zero-based budgeting, and if we come back with a response on zero-based budgeting to show here's what a 5% increment of maintenance is in Region 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then build each one of those 5% packages from zero, it does get quite costly, and we'd want to make sure we're working with your staff and the members to make sure we're getting you what you need and yet having a return on the investment. The big concern about zero-based budgeting as a detail item is that it's been stopped in most governmental entities because it is so labor-intensive, and they've gone to something that, like what we're trying to do with the program budget, which is communicate the program but not have 5% incremental packages. Does that answer your question, Mr. Chair?
Well, okay, then if I can take you back to page 2 of your presentation, where does the cost accounting element fit in? Is that the financial services with 168 FTE?
Correct.
How much is that being increased or raised in anticipation of the cost accounting?
Mr. Chair, we're taking a least cost approach. We have 9 positions that are involved in it. We're not increasing that unit in this budget. And we're using costs and projected S&S costs that are in the current budget. So we're not increasing it. We're working through the remainder of this biennium as well as into the next. As I mentioned in the Senate Transportation Committee, we could request additional funds and move that on a faster basis. But one of our concerns is that not only doing the work of identifying the accounting and programming work, it's also communicating with our own employees and bringing employees along so they're prepared to do this at a more detailed level and understand the importance of accurate accounting. If we try to move it too fast, I'm afraid we'd have a little bit of a rebellion internally in terms of understanding the importance of the accounting at this level. And I think by doing it this way, less cost, it also results in a more effective product as long as we're meeting the needs of the legislature on timing.
Okay. Question?
We're happy to put in a package that the chair would like.
No, I'm just, I guess I'm just frustrated. Sitting on the Transportation Committee and being here, I hear ODOT throwing this around that we're going to get cost accounting regardless whether we pass the bill or not. And cost accounting conceptually sounds good. But in a few days here, we're going to look at zero-based budgeting, some of your maintenance and your other activities. And I just want to make sure that we all understand that when we start breaking that down,
We're going to be looking at projects, geographic areas, and the costs associated with the uniqueness of that area versus just plain laying asphalt down and charging X amount of dollars a running foot.
Correct. And Mr. Chair, to get specifically to that, each one of those elements, like determining what the cost per running foot will be or cost per mile, will have a several pieces to it. One will say the indirect portions of doing that cost per mile or this amount, in other words, engineering time during the project, administrative costs for this amount, and of the direct costs, these are the amounts that are part of that cost per mile. So I think it will get that detail that the Chair is seeking.
And the other question I want to ask you is on the T21 funds. I'm getting a lot of concerns expressed to me by some of my colleagues that T21 is being used for possibly everything from A to Z rather than getting out on the highways or fixing the infrastructure that we have in place. My question on T21 is it really as open-ended as some people are being led to believe, because we're using it on land use planning, we're using it on transportation growth management. Pardon me?
Environmental quality.
Yeah, environmental quality. I mean, we're using a whole bunch of activities for a resource, and it seems like we're backing in the T21 funds at the same time backing out other funds and then redirecting those funds in other places in the budget. Was that really the intent of Congress to do that generic and say one size fits all? If you meet the definition, you can use T21 funds?
Mr. Chair, I think the Congress would say it certainly isn't a one size fits all. I think they have earmarked significant portions of T21, and to make sure we're all clear, T21 isn't just a piece of legislation. It is the entire Federal Department of Transportation appropriations measure. So it's got all those elements that might be earmarked specific projects, like Chairman Montgomery of the Transportation Committee talked about many times, some projects that he doesn't necessarily like that have been earmarked, and that's where the money has to go. There are other projects that obviously local governments significantly want. There are elements that are flexible. For instance, one of the packages mentioned earlier deals with the Oregon Transportation Network, and that package is 10% or $10 million of general fund and $10 million of flexible funds. We want to make sure that was clear that is flexible, and although it goes for in the governor's recommended budget for the transportation network and the brokerage function of getting the local providers together, it could go on the road. So that clearly could. So there is some that can. However, there are significant amounts of it that cannot. And I believe one of our questions from an earlier committee hearing was to address that, and I'll go back and see where that one is.
Okay, good. I was watching the Portland news this morning. Maybe I shouldn't be there, but I was watching it. And they were talking about spending federal highway funds on repairing some more bridges in Portland. And I had a difficult time relating, what does a bridge in Portland have to do with my freeway in Southern Oregon, as an example? And since it's not a state highway that goes across the bridge, it's a city street that goes across the bridge. I was just thinking to myself when I saw that there's a lot of money that's being plowed into bridge maintenance, and they alluded to the fact that it was, they didn't specifically call it T21, but they said federal funds, and there's only one place NANA comes from, and that's the big white capital in Washington, D.C. Representative Schrader,
a follow-up on your concerns today, I have some of the same, and would it be possible to get a summary of the categorical funding restrictions for T21, and then below that kind of a comparison of how ODOT is using those funds, and then maybe a third thing, you know, could some of these funds go to highway, and in which areas? And that would kind of help us, I think, get a handle.
Mm-hmm. Right. Representative Starr.
Since you opened up this discussion, Mr. Chair, I'd like to jump in on it. You mentioned that some of the T21 dollars are flexible and some are not. Who decides?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, the federal government determines what's flexible and what's not. They can earmark certain portions of the bill. They can make other portions that are slightly flexible by giving certain criteria, and others that are quite flexible.
I can follow up, Mr. Chair.
Well, let me ask you a question, because you didn't answer his question. Who makes the decision in Oregon to take P21 funds and spend it on environmental or land use, or who makes the decision? That was his question.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I took it as who from the federal government makes a decision about whether it's flexible. Pardon me. Within Oregon, a decision is made by the Transportation Commission in conjunction with the governor. So sometimes it's the governor making this decision directly, sometimes it's the Transportation Commission. Other times it's staff within the Department of Transportation that are making recommendations forward.
If I can follow up.
Yes, sir.
As far as the federal dollars that are earmarked at the federal level for specific projects in Oregon, who makes that decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, the earmarking of projects is done by activity by local governments and sometimes ODOT highlighting a concern. So
if I can follow up on that?
Yes.
So what you're telling me is that you have ODOT staff, perhaps, that are working in Washington, D.C. With our congressional representatives to say, here's a list of projects that we'd like to get funded.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, there are people on the communication staff that communicate what's called a briefing book that's been requested initially by Senator Hatfield, and now since then has been requested by each delegation to make sure they understand what is the information about where transportation issues are within Oregon. And we send information in that effect. Local governments send information indirectly. Some of these earmarks come from local government activity where they're seeking a specific thing that may not have been in our overall briefing book. But we do send information to that effect.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? Sure. Do you have any employees working in Washington, D.C. as well as to the federal government?
Mr. Chair, we don't have any...
Or contractors?
Mr. Chair, we do not have employees. We do have a contract with a firm that does make sure that the information about transportation needs in Oregon are communicated, yes. Mike,
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mike, how much money are we spending in Washington, D.C. to try to direct dollars to specific programs?
Mr. Chair, I believe the most recent contract was in the neighborhood of about $270,000 for a biennium.
Mr. Chair, if I just make a comment. What I'm concerned about is we've got folks in through ODOT and through local governments as well that have a bias and a bias toward transit-oriented development, pedestrian-friendly development, land use management, all the issues that we've been talking about in this committee. And they have an agenda, and they go to our Congress and say, hey, we have this list of projects that we need to get funded, and with that bias in mind, dollars get sent back to Oregon, saying you gotta spend X number of dollars on these variety of projects. And that's a concern that I have, with, because we get this, all that comes in and says, well, we've got, I forget the number, $120 million and $221 coming into the state, but you can only spend $60 million of them, or whatever the number is, 80 some million of them, because the rest of it's been earmarked already. And the reason that they're earmarked is because ODOT and local government or whoever put the list together and says, and we have a lobbying firm in Washington, D.C. lobbying Congress to say we've got to fund these projects. So the circle is connected, and the money isn't spent on our roads, where, as I mentioned the other day, with our planning division of ODOT, we don't have an idea that the job of this department is to get asphalt on the road so that we can move people and products efficiently through this state. And that's where, if you want to talk about livability, that's where you talk about livability. Talk about livability by moving people and products through this state, reducing congestion, talk about environmental concerns, when you have cars sitting on the freeway pumping out the pollution instead of driving us at the rate which they should be, that's where we create problems. So I'm just concerned about that, with this portion of the budget.
Senator Gates.
We've never haven't had a chance to look through this little booklet that we all were given. They should. And it's part of the discussion we're in around what can we do. This little insert is really good. And it talks about what the federal government intended. As they put the T21 money together, a cleaner environment, increased safety, rebuilding America, creating jobs, that sort of thing. So that it isn't all just ODOT's interpretation. However, choices exist. A lot of choices exist within this money. That's why they call it flexible. It can go either way. And I know I asked the Transportation Commission and Transportation Committee one day if they supported the governor's livability proposal, and they didn't know what it was. So I think that the decisions are not being made at the ODOT level. They're being made above that. A question for Mike. Who is Jason Tell's employer?
Mr. Chair and Senators, Jason Tell's employer is ODOT. He works for the Department of Transportation. He works in the communications area.
He spends a fair amount of his time in Washington, D.C., doesn't he?
He is our primary federal government contact person, yes. So he's the one that knows the process the best.
As Representative Starr was asking about employees of ODOT, and clearly the biggest presence on the Hill that we have is through contracts in D.C., but we do have ODOT employees who spend a lot of time, and their job is to move legislation in Washington, D.C. along. And
Chair,
I'm not sure exactly who directs him in that legislation, only that I tried to climb over him a couple of times, and this is easy to do.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I wouldn't say his job is to move legislation, but I would say that it certainly is to make sure information is communicated there so that the congressional members have the information. And he is to know the process so that if we have questions about where things are, he can let us know where things are in process. The contractors are the ones that I think were most directly there. And although he goes there, I can find out how often he goes, but I mean, certainly as a Salem employee.
And he puts together the briefing books that are delivered to the members of Congress that the contract lobbyists then push to get funded.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I think he does most of the work related to that, yes.
The other thing I wanted to point out is that the earmarked pieces of T21 are actually earmarked by members of Congress. I watched that process happen in the first congressional district, but staff of congressional members actually contacted local governments and local taxing districts and said, what would you like to have? And then assembled that, and we see the outcome. But that wasn't ODOT. In fact, in some cases, my guess is ODOT would prefer that some of those projects hadn't happened, but there they are anyway.
Mr. Chair, certainly the case, our belief is to try to use the public process rather than earmarking for specific areas, and whenever you earmark it, brings it out of that public prioritization process. I did want to mention to Representative Starr that although there are significant areas of earmarking that do occur, there still is a significant requirement to say, although whatever it is, transit or highway or aeronautics money is coming, it is within a silo and it doesn't move across to the other area for the most part. There are flexible funds, but for the most part, those funds are to be spent in that area. The reason why we feel like there's a return on the investment for being there, whether it's the Salem person or the contractor in Washington, D.C., is letting them know our concerns is what results in those monies coming to Oregon instead of going to another state, which is the issue here, not that it's going to transit rather than highway, but more commonly that it's going to go for a transit project in another state or it's going to go for an aeronautics project in another state. We want to make sure our concerns are understood by those members. Same thing for the National Guard. They have a major presence there to make sure, and they have a briefing book of their own that deals with armory needs and other things, and have a session there when it used to be associated with them. Each entity that has a federal connection needs to make sure that's understood so that decisions are made to help us here in Oregon.
Okay. Representative Patrick.
Mike, are you guys lobbying in D.C. on the earmarking of specific projects, and if so, who sets that agenda for ODA?
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, I'm new enough, I hate to say that I don't have enough background yet to say that we are for sure lobbying on specific earmarking. We are lobbying to, or getting information to them. We are working through an entity there to get information to them relating to projects. My guess is on most of those earmarks, we're trying to keep it in the general pot. But I'm sure there are some examples where we've supported a local government to say that, yes, that's a good project, and we support that occurring. And if you want more detail than that, I can get more detail.
One of the questions, just as a side, as someone who's watched the Hill Pride, the D.C. process, from that perspective, a lot of remarking goes on that has nothing to do with our staff or whatever else goes on. It has to do with, a lot of times, which community is they're beating the drum the loudest. And
I think
if you listened to NPR last week, they had the chair of the House Transportation Committee on it. He seems to have had much more I don't remember what his
name
is. Yeah, and he's got so many projects in his district, it's unbelievable. So there's a lot of vote trading that goes on through these transportation dollars.
I think it might be helpful to compare what is earmarked in your budget plan versus how much is in the general kitty. So we can take a look at it here. Particularly something we want to discuss with local government, because if one entity comes in and says, I want this project funded, but they were involved in earmarking, I'm not too inclined to remove them out of the priority process or the STIP and move them over to somebody else if they've been involved in cutting their own sweetheart deal. And that bothers me that if our congressional people are calling cities in their districts and saying, what do you need? And then they come to the state and want us to play the same game that the federal government is playing, throwing the priority thing out the door and just designating projects. I'd rather not head down that path. Senator Dukes.
Mr. Chair. The way ODOT conducts its business today, let me give you an example. As I said, I would like to go with you, but I can't quite. We have this transit district in Clatsop County that would like to do a multimodal station in Astoria. And they tried and they tried and they tried to work through ODOT. And every time they turned around, the goalposts moved. And they had a great deal of difficulty getting adequate information. They were refused by Mr. Tell to go into the briefing book. He finally told me he didn't think the project was doable. We laid it all out for him, but he didn't think it was doable, so it didn't go into the briefing book. So, the district had the pieces together, so they went to their member of Congress, and they got the money to design it. They're trying to do step-by-step to design it. Then ODOT got their foot in the way again, and so we're trying to work around them, and given some changes that have happened in the transit section, I think we may get there. It's a good project. It has an incredible amount of support, but there seems to be very little flexibility in the folks who are making the decision. And after a while, I don't know what you do. It's like the Astoria Bypass, which has been at least 30 years in the design and review. Since 1980, Secretary of State's office tells me ODOT has spent about $2 million just in looking at that project. We've got the Lewis and Clark Bicentennial coming up. We are facing absolute gridlock in Clatsop County if we can't get that other route around. I can't get it on anything. It's been all the way to the top of the skip, and it's been back off again, and all the way back to the top of the skip and back. I was once told by a former head of highways that it was the most important project to hold up in the state of Oregon. He's gone now for the project. And as long as we're doing those kinds of things, and now we're at 80% maintenance and only 20% construction, there's no chance the Clatsop County can get that project unless they go to the federal government. So as long as those kinds of games are going on, I can't fault somebody for going around. If we could ever corral all the money and get it into the highways, then I would be right with you. I think then it's a mistake to go around.
Well, I appreciate that. I think you've raised one of the central issues here, that we're getting funds given to the state and somewhere along the line the decision's being made for us. Whereas I'd rather receive the funds and make the decision allocation here. Representative Beck?
I just wanted to respond to Representative Starr's comment a little bit. I think the T21, when you look at proportionality of where most of these set of funds are going, they're going to vote. I mean, I think that we need to put this in perspective, that the lion's share of all this money is going to the highway. And while some of it is flexible and has moved in areas that you know, two people may disagree about, I think it's really important to keep in mind where most of this money is going. And also, I would encourage you to talk to some of the employers in the metro area. Intel, I think, has a few employees in your district. I think if you talk to them about how they felt federal funding was being invested in their community, they would be quite pleased with the flexible funding and the alternative modes that are being created, because mobility is about more than just roads. They like the transit, they want to get their employees to and from work, but also the free get cars off the road so their trucks can travel to and from the airport and so forth. So I think if JPASS in the metro area, a lot of these decisions in my community are decided on at the local level. So the business community and the local politicians and the agencies get together. And once a month, and they talk and talk and talk, and then over time they reach a lot of consensus. And they meet 7:30 once a month, every month, in somewhere in Portland. And it's not like these things are arbitrary. And I think people in my community overall are very happy with the flexibility. In fact, we'd like to see more. But most of this money goes to roads. I think it's really important to remind ourselves of that.
Representative Patrick. I just wanted to say, as we're talking about the federal process and earmarking and all that, I'm glad that, not that there hasn't been pressure and earmarking over the course of history in Oregon, and not that we have the perfect system, but I'm happy that we don't have that kind of earmarking system, because this debate would take on a whole different character in this committee if that was the case.
It would look like a Super Bowl in here. Representative Starr?
Just Chris, I don't want to belabor the point with Representative Zach, but my community seems light right under town. Almost $1 billion spent on other than road projects. And I think it's just time that we look at spending transportation dollars for the rest of us. Light rail is fine for those that you can use it, but it hasn't impacted our transportation. If you look at passenger cars on Highway 26 prior to light rail and post light rail, how TriMet has changed its bus route. If TriMet had kept the bus route that it had originally and had light rail, that things might have been different. But,
We have approximately 5 minutes. The Senate has to go into session at 10.
Okay, Mr. Chair. I'll move quickly to the program announcement.
Now we've had a good dialogue here.
I did want to mention one other thing about our information system for Representative Schrader. I mentioned one major. Another major is the information system budget per agency employee. And again, that's another national standard that we've looked at. And the national average is $6,787 for the information systems budget per agency employee. The 1999-01 budget for ODOT is $6,250. So again, we're lower than the national standard costs for other governmental entities.
Representative Schrader?
Afternoon, I'd like to chat about how the numbers are derived, and I have some other questions that we'll bring back in the
today. Okay.
Thank you very much.
You bet. I'll skip the goals for now, Mr. Chair. Be open to any questions from the members. Some other point, try to get on quickly through the budget highlights. I did want to at least get to the members a couple of things so that you can track. I believe in a prior letter you have something that said essential services assessment.
Right.
And I did want to make sure the members had that in their packet for use during the work session or any other questions. The bottom line for that is that you have two different options for receiving essential services payments. One is through an assessment which goes against the entity and it comes out of their revenues most of the time. The other is a fee for service. what we're trying to move to wherever we can is a fee for service. If it makes sense and we can show the customer a direct connection between the service that we're providing and the cost of that service, to have a fee to be able to show that they're receiving that service instead of a general assessment. However, for many of our functions, it isn't cost effective, and you'll see in most state agencies, they do use an assessment process to assess an agency for general services they're receiving rather than accounting for each individual detailed service at a detail level.
Excuse me, Mike.
Yes,
Senator Gates.
Mike, you were going to get me a listing of what all services are included in the general assessment that ODOT does and how those are calculated. Did that happen and I looked at...
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, it is in one of the items that was submitted back. I forget the date, and at the end
of the next day, printed answers. Oh,
correct. I know we've come back with a lot of answers, and it can get very confusing. I'll make sure we track that at the end this morning.
Senator Yee.
I have a question regarding the budget. People are very concerned with the number of auditors you have in auditing weight mile tests. Now, are those auditors in this division, or is it in motor carrier division?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, yes, those are in this division. As far as the auditors, the program people for the across-the-counter work of motor carriers and the motor carrier transportation division, the auditors are in our division. I can pull out measures, though, for Senator Hannon and Senator Yee that relate to the cost of each auditor and the amount of revenue that they're receiving. The fact is that the revenue received per audit is significant, and so they're more than paying for the cost of those auditors.
What I'm interested in is how many auditors are there involved in auditing the Waymark tech system?
Okay. Senator Yee, I'll get that for you. I can actually turn around in just a minute and get that. I think it's critical, though, to remember in terms of policy and systems, if we had a diesel tax and did not have a weight mile system, there would not be the same level of staff and motor carrier and in our audit function. They're not doing the same work. But the policy issue is whether we feel like there's a return on investment because you're having the heavier vehicles paying more and whether that's something you want to spend the time administering. The past would determine that it was worth that extra administration. The members decided to not have that and go to the diesel tax, and we can make reductions in terms of the administration of that system. Mr. Chair, I'll go briefly into a couple of other points. In terms of the shift, DAS mentioned at the very beginning of the budget discussion that there is a $21 million increase in our budget in terms of the expenditures shown. That is the result of the Central Services Assessment change, where we made a tough decision that said rather than having the operating divisions retain expenditure authority for things that relate to information systems, that we would transfer that authority into the Central Services pod, if you will, so that we can manage that better. It doesn't result in any additional cost, although you see on page 7 a $21 million increase in other Central Services. That is because of that shift that DAS mentioned. And I have a charting of that, again, the Central Services Assessment piece that came in the prior packet, and I can point out the date for that to the members or give them a new copy if they wish, which I have here. Looks like this and tracks through that information in detail. The other piece that I want to give the members now, just so that there's any questions that may come up in the future, and the cost accounting program, and I know there's been a lot of questions and issues about it. I won't take the time now so we can make sure we get to the program option packages, but this discusses what our goals are there. And again, this is cost accounting, which talks about getting the cost of an output or cost per unit of service. It's not accounting where you're paying your bills or showing where a project is in the midst of the project. It's cost accounting. And we want to make sure we identify the administrative, indirect, and direct costs that are part of the work that we do. I'd like to spend more time on that, but I think I'm going to get to our program option packages, which are on page 8 of the handout, and go through those briefly. Again, the same situation in terms of full-time equivalent positions. We have within our budget 9.78 FTE full-time equivalent positions that are limited duration for year 2000. On the information system side for the consultants, we talked about the reasons for those that shift of the 32 FTE. that there's no increase in cost for those positions. The result is because we have 40% turnover on our contractors, we hire with contractors, their employees turn over and move over to another entity, and we don't have the kind of a continuity on the work on the projects. Plus, the cost of those contractors are significantly more, and I do have a handout on that that I can give any members that are interested that goes through that in a little more detail. And it looks like this. I'll just hand that to the staff when we're done, and particularly Representative Schrager might be having interest in that. The next area is reprographics, transfer to non-limited. And it looks like I won't get to the non-limited discussion today, but I just want to make sure members understand the concept. The legislature does not set dollar limits on non-limited. The non-limited idea is that when a portion of the budget is controlled not by the agency, but by the customers to the agency. So an example would be reprographics or photographers, where they're totally controlled by how often the agency uses them. And that, therefore, there's not a limit by the legislature or a financial limitation by the legislature, but there's a limitation by the marketplace, in essence. It's a marketplace-driven, demand-driven, and those non-limited expenditures are ones we'll get into next time we get together. But what we're doing here is saying that a couple areas, reprographic area, ought to be under non-limited so that we're consistent within the department. The supply area is one that we're bringing back from non-limited because we believe the component that deals with items that are no longer in inventory and they're going through an order process are not as much driven by the demand of customers. So we're trying to make our shifts appropriately within statewide consistency. Mr. Chair and Senator, you were talking about photography, copy center, functions of copying and getting material out to entities within the organization. So we have a major copy center, we have photographers, we have large copying of blueprints on projects, that kind of work, to reproduce or reproduce copies of materials.
Is this a new word?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, people don't use the word reprographics very much, but it's talking about reproducing graphical material. Don't mean to be too technical here. Moving on to the last item under staffing was traffic management. We're transferring from highway some technical folks who relate to taking care of ramp meters, variable messaging signs, traffic cameras, this kind of function. It really is more of an information technology function, so that's coming into social services. Mr. Chair, in just a couple minutes, I wanted to indicate on a couple of these option packages a little bit of detail. One is under options for change. This is what we would call a reduction option. In other agencies, they have, as you've seen in the budget, a reduction option, which they have not actually taken. In this case, the Department of Transportation is suggesting this option and has actually taken it, in our case, within Central Services to the tune of over $1.9 million. There are reductions in staffing and consultants and focusing on different kinds of work on applications development. It's trying to find all sorts of areas to make reductions in order to get us below the revenue level we have in the agency. Unlike most agencies, I think we mentioned at the very first day of the Department of Transportation discussion, our current service level is here, our revenues available are here. So therefore, unlike most agencies that might get a package that goes up to their revenue level, we don't have enough revenue to do our current service level. So we have to make that reduction, and that's what these options for change are within each division. We've mentioned it in others, but I wanted to make sure you understood that with our division in particular. The second area I want to spend just a minute on was talking about those information systems services and installation. The fact is that we've worked with the Department of Administrative Services and looked at the marketplace and what's happening with the cost of those that inflation for services, and see that the contractors' costs are expected to go up about 40% over this next period. So I think you'll see in most agencies that have significant year 2000 issues that and significant amount of contractors that they're planning for this level of increase, and this is not inconsistent in terms of what ODOT is requesting. Mr. Chair, since I only have a couple minutes, I can go through others, but maybe I should leave it to questions of the
chair. We need to have some questions, but Representative Schrager.
But on the last two points that you made, you indicated there were some staffing reductions in 116, and yet it's not listed in the chart you give, or did I misunderstand? And then the other thing you indicated is that contractors' costs are expected to go up. But I have not heard that in any of the other committees I've been on. I haven't had any packages come in. Maybe the other members have. So I'm curious. It seems to be unique for ODOT to request this, is my impression.
Mr. Chair, Administrator, we've worked with the Department of Administrative Services to ensure we have the same assumption. So we know that in DAS and DHR and the large centers where we have significant amounts of work that they're looking at the same issues. Now, talking about a more modest-sized agency that might not have as significant a data issues, that might not be the case. The second thing is, in terms of the FTE, there isn't an actual FTE reduction. We're reducing the use of temporary staff, consultants, services and supplies, professional services, that type of thing. So we have not reduced the FTE there, mainly because of that need to use additional FTE on the to replace contractors and result in more efficient work because we're paying less for them. And I do have that handout that I can give the members that walks through that in a little more detail.
Okay. All right. Now, the announcements. In front of everybody is a handout on Senate Bill 5528, Oregon State Marine Board. We're going to have a public hearing and work session on this tomorrow. It's another fund budget. We have no general fund money. So we're going to have a hearing and a work session. We will resume ODOT on Wednesday. Starting Wednesday, we would like to convene at 8 a.m. from now on. And we're going to have a Friday meeting this week after the full Ways and Means Committee. We need to move along on schedule, and it's defeated in the co-chairs as long as the Senate is convening at 10 a.m. right now. So we should be meeting at 8 a.m. So that's business.
Mr. Chair, there will be a full Ways and Means tomorrow at 8 o'clock, is that correct?
I believe there is. But it should take a matter of 15 minutes or so. Okay. Unless you talk too loud.
I won't say words.
Okay.
There are two budgets, higher ed and charter school.
Yeah. Senator Duke.
I may be, Mr. Chair, the only one in this position, but on at least one day a week, I have a 7 a.m. meeting that runs to 8:30. It's the Salmon Committee.
That's fine. We'll try to accommodate.
Seems like it's more than one day, but it's definitely one day.
Okay. We'll try to accommodate you as much.
Are we starting at 8 tomorrow?
No, we have to get 36 hours notice, so we'll make it official for Wednesday morning at 8.
That's okay.
Okay, is there further discussion? If not, we are adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow morning.